You will have no doubt observed and recognized that we are not following an in-depth verse-by-verse study of this letter. I am merely giving a general and a brief outline, a brief summary of each chapter. My aim is simply to introduce us and to acquaint us with this great epistle, to introduce and acquaint us with its content, and it is my hope that you will then take time on your own to read through and study in greater detail what the Apostle Paul is saying to us. Now, having said that, chapter 7 is a chapter which I feel compelled to look at a little more closely. Not only because it is one of the most difficult parts of this letter, but because of its immense importance and significance to the Christian life. When we understand what Paul is saying here, and when we grasp it, and it is no easy thing to grasp and to understand what Paul is saying. This is one of those passages that Peter referred to in Paul's letter as being hard to be understood. This is a difficult passage. But when we grasp it, when we understand it, we will benefit tremendously from it in our day-to-day practical Christian living. It is in this chapter and in the next chapter that Paul demonstrates how our union with Christ gives us and brings us into victorious, overcoming Christian living. Now, before we look at the chapter, I think it's necessary to give a brief reminder of where we are at in the letter. You will remember that chapter 5 marks that point in the letter where Paul begins to deal with the benefits of the gospel. What does the gospel bring? What is the consequence of the gospel? And in that chapter he shows us that it is eternal salvation. We are delivered from wrath through him, or in union with Christ. As a consequence of our union with Christ, the child of God is eternally secure, and he will be delivered from the coming day of wrath. Then in chapter 6 and 7, he digresses for a while in order to deal with two problems or two objections which troubled the church at that time. Namely, the objection regarding sin, and then the objection regarding the law of God. Chapter 6 deals with sin. Look at verse 1. What shall we say then to this? This gospel that brings us into union with Christ, that justifies us from all the guilt of our sin, that delivers us from the wrath of God, and makes us eternally secure. What shall we say then? Because we're saved by grace, and grace is magnified in our sinful condition, shall we then continue in sin that grace may abound? He's taking up the objection that was held by some that because they were saved by grace, they then had license to live in sin. And Paul shows here that when we were brought into union with Christ, the effect of that was to die to sin. You become dead to sin. We died to sin. And therefore it's a contradiction. It is inconsistent for a Christian to live habitually in sin. Now, there may be times when he sins, and that is made clear in John's epistle when he says, I write these things that you sin not, but if any man sin, we have an advocate with the Father. So there is a possibility of a child of God falling into sin, but what Paul is dealing with here is an habitual life of sin. And he says it's a contradiction to the gospel. It's a contradiction to this salvation. When you were brought in union to Christ, that moment you died to sin regarding its guilt and its power. And Christ now has raised you to walk in newness of life, to walk in a life of godliness. Now then, towards the end of chapter 6, into chapter 7, he takes up the objection regarding the law of God. He takes up that phrase in verse 15, "What then? Shall we sin because we're not under law, but under grace? God forbid." You see, he switches to the other side of the coin. And he brings us now to the subject of the law of God. And he addresses the objection that was raised by some in the early church, that because we're not under law, therefore we no longer need to live by the law or according to God's law. And so he deals with this objection, showing us what it means to be no longer under the law. And as we looked last time, in chapter 7, we saw that it means we're no longer under the law as a covenant by which we obtain life. We're no longer under the law in that respect. We are dead to the law. Christ has fulfilled that covenant, the covenant of the law, the covenant of works. And by his righteousness and obedience, he has obtained life for us. He has obtained that favor. And by faith, we enter into union with him and we become partaker of all the benefits of his righteousness and his obedience, and therefore we pass from the law as a covenant of works on the life. We escape its penalty, and we enjoy all the rewards which Christ's obedience to the law has brought. Now this brings us to verse 7, and our study for today. Paul then asks the question, what shall we say then to this? What shall we say then? Is the law sin? God forbid. I have not known sin but by the law, for I have not known lust, except the law had said, thou shalt not covet. Now he's following on from what he has been saying. If we are dead to sin, if we are dead to the law as a covenant of works, no longer under the law as a covenant, how then should we view God's law? That's the essence of what he's saying here. What shall we say then? If we are no longer under the law as a covenant of works to obtain life and favor, how then should we view God's law? What should our perception of God's law be? How should we consider and understand the law of God? And in the next verses here, he gives to us what the believer's perception and estimation of God's law should be. How we should view the law of God. When you study these verses, you'll find that he identifies three characteristics. First of all, he identifies the perfection of God's law. Verse 7, is the law sin? Is there something wrong with God's law? Now that we are under grace, now that we have been partakers of the gospel, now that we have entered into union with Christ and we possess and enjoy his salvation, should we consider God's law to have some deficiency or some imperfection in it? Do we diminish or despise the law of God? Is the law sin? What is his answer? Nay, God forbid. God forbid. In other words, he's saying that God's law should not be viewed with disrespect by believers. It ought to be held in the highest esteem and with the greatest reverence. Look at verse 12. He says, wherefore, the law is holy, and the commandment holy, and just and good. Verse 14, for we truth of the law of God. What are they? They are the reflection of the very nature of God Himself. Is God holy? Is God just? Is God good? They are all the attributes of God Himself. And Paul takes those attributes and he applies them to the law of God. And in doing so, he is reminding us how we should perceive the law, what we should perceive it to be. It is the very reflection of what God Himself is. The law is the written transcript of what God Himself is. It is the mirror of His holiness. And therefore, it can never be lightly esteemed by any man, let alone any believer. The law is the revelation of God's will. It reveals the sum total of man's duty and man's responsibility, first to God and then to his fellow man. It was first inscribed upon man's heart at the time of creation. And then it was given at Mount Sinai upon tables of stone in written form. You remember the Lord Jesus summarized the law as the duty to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind, and to love thy neighbor as thyself. That is the sum total of the law of God. Now this, Paul affirms, is perfect. There's no flaw in God's law. There's no deficiency in God's law. We should never come to God's law with a low estimation of it. It is the reflection of the very nature of God Himself. It tells us who He is and what He is. And it reveals to us our duty to Him. Now it comes as no surprise to believers that the men of the world, ungodly men, revile and reject the law of God. That is the attitude of the world. Look at our nation today. What is it seeking to do? It's seeking to cast off the laws of God. Because they revile and they reject God's law. But what Paul says about the law of God in these verses prohibits us from ever adopting the view which the world has. We should not follow in the vein of the world in its attitude to God's law. God's law must never be diminished in our opinion. It is holy, it is just, and it is good. So he highlights first of all the perfection of God's law. And then secondly, he identifies the purpose of God's law. Verse 7, what shall we say then? Is the law sin? God forbid. Nay, I have not known sin but by the law. By the law. Now he's informing us of the purpose which the law of God performs. It is a purpose of revelation. It reveals and informs us of certain things. And in this instance, Paul is telling us that the law reveals what sin is. It is the law which teaches us what sin is. It teaches us, furthermore, that we are sinners, standing therefore in need of salvation. God's law has two sides to it. It has a positive side. It has a negative side. There are positive requirements. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. And then there are negative prohibitions. Thou shalt not. Thou shalt not commit adultery. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not kill. It is positive and it is negative. It prohibits certain things. And then it demands others. tells us what we ought to be and what we ought to do. And it tells us what we ought not to be and what we ought not to do. The purpose of this revelatory function is to convince the heart of its sinfulness. I want you to grasp this. Paul is saying, this is why we have the law. This is why it was necessary for God to give the law in a written form. It was given in order to reveal sin and to convince us of our sinfulness. I had not known sin but by the law. He's already mentioned this previously in chapter 3 when he says that by the law is the knowledge of sin. The law brings this knowledge of sin. And now he's saying, I have not known sin but by the law. It is the law that has brought me to the place where I see my true condition before God. It is the law that has brought me to the place where I recognize that I stand in need of salvation and deliverance. Look at what he says in verse 8 of this chapter. But sin, taking occasion by the commandment, wrought in me all manner of concupiscence. What does he mean by this? Well, what he's simply saying is that when the law of God came to his attention, when he was brought to consider what the law was, what it said, it had the result or the consequence of bringing about rebellion within his own heart. Sin taking occasion by the commandment. In other words, sin reacted to the commandment. Sin responded through the law by rising up in rebellion and working within me all manner of concupiscence or evil desire or evil lust. John Bunyan, in his Pilgrim's Progress, gives us a wonderful illustration of this. When he got to the interpreter's house after he had been to the cross, Pilgrim went in there and he saw the room covered with dust. And the man took the brush and he started to attempt to brush up all the dust. But as he started to brush the dust of course was stirred up into the air and it began to choke him and he couldn't see. And then there was one who came along and he sprinkled water over the floor, over the dust. And then he was able to brush up the dust into the pan without it being stirred up into the atmosphere. And the principle that Bunyan was conveying was this, that when the law comes to us with all its righteous demands, with all its righteous prohibitions, the effect of the law within our hearts is to stir up sin all the more. Now Paul is doing two things here. He's showing us, in the first place, that the law was never given as a way of salvation. Look what he says in verse 11. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me. And by it, that is by the law, sin slew me. That's the opposite of life. And he's saying now that the law was never given to be a way or a means of salvation for sinners. It was given as a covenant of works unto life for Adam in his created and unfallen state. And Adam had the ability to obey that law and to merit that life. But the law was never given as a way of salvation. Every time the law will have the effect of stirring up sin, and it will only slay the sinner, making him to see his sin, his helplessness, and his inability. But then Paul shows us here in this purpose the necessity of the law in preaching the gospel. It is the gospel alone that brings salvation. But the heart of man will only see its need of salvation when it is convinced of its sin. And that is produced by the law. Martin Luther said that the law ought never to be preached apart from the gospel, and that the gospel ought never to be preached apart from the law. You know the reason why so many gospel evangelistic efforts are fruitless compared to other days and other generations? It's because this principle has been forgotten. It used to be in the history of the church here that churches would preach the law. They would preach what God requires of man, what man's duty is to God. And the effect of that would be conviction in the heart of the sinner, realizing his sinfulness and his inability to meet that demand and standard. And then he would be slain. And as a slain soul, he would be left with no other option but to cry out to God for mercy. And then they would bring the gospel. And the healing ointment of the gospel would bind up the wounds that were brought about by the slaying of the law. But you see, that method and that approach has been jettisoned by much of the professing church today. And the law, because the true function and purpose of the law has not been rightly understood, therefore the law has been cast to the side and treated as irrelevant. And because of that, the gospel does not have the effect that it used to have in our nation. If you read the history, you will find this over and over again. And the one point in history that stands out the most in my mind was that time of the great revival in the Blackwater district in County Antrim. There was a minister there, James Glendinning, and all he preached was the law and the terrors of judgment. And the result was that his hearers were smitten. And they would cling to the very pews of the church under a deep sense of conviction. But that's as far as he seemed to go. And the presbytery at the time sent men like John Livingstone and Robert Blair, who had already been used mightily here in Scotland. They sent them to preach the gospel. And when they preached the gospel, there was a bountiful harvest because the groundwork had been already done. The heart had been plied up by the law. And they were ready to receive the gospel. So he says to us, we should recognize the perfection of the law. And then we should recognize the purpose of the law. But thirdly, Paul identifies the powerlessness of the law. And this really takes us from verse 14 right through the end of the chapter into chapter 8. And he summarizes it in verse 3 of chapter 8. Look what he says there. For what the law could not do. There's the limitation of God's law. There's the powerlessness of God's law. God's law, Paul having showed us what God's law does, revealing God's standard of righteousness and exposing sin and convincing us of sin, he then proceeds to concentrate upon what the law cannot do. And to sum it up, it cannot see it, nor can it sanctify. It cannot save the sinner, and it cannot sanctify the believer. John Brown of Edinburgh, and I don't know if he was an ancestor of another Mr. Brown in the news this week, but John Brown of Edinburgh was a tremendous preacher and a man who wrote tremendous commentaries. But he sums up this chapter 7 in a brilliant and in a succinct fashion. He takes chapter 7 and he says that it sets out two things. First of all, the law cannot make a bad man good. And secondly, the law cannot make a good man better. The law cannot make a bad man good. It cannot justify the sinner. It cannot save the sinner. And it cannot make a good man better. It cannot sanctify the believer. We all are acquainted with the first point, that it cannot justify a sinner. Paul has adequately covered this in the first part of the previous chapters of the letter. We're not justified by trying to obey the law of God. That's an impossibility. But here he focuses upon another error which so many believers fall into. They grasp justification by faith in Christ, but when it comes to sanctification, they go drastically wrong. For they revert to a theory of law-keeping as the basis of sanctification. They're prepared to look to Christ for justification from the guilt of sin, but then they turn to the law, and they look to the law for sanctification from the power of sin. But that is a travesty of the gospel. That is a travesty of the gospel. As I look to Christ by faith for justification, so I must look to him by faith for my sanctification day by day. It's not my effort or my ability to try and keep the law and all its duties and all its regulations. If I go down that route, it'll lead to what Paul identifies here in the latter part of the chapter, when he says, "O wretched man that I am." I will look at this more fully next Lord's Day. But I just want to introduce it here at this point. And I want you to think about this. I want you to read these verses through this week. And then we'll come to look at what Paul is saying here. But the basis of what he is saying is that if we try to seek sanctification by trying to obey the law, then it will only bring us into bondage and misery and despair. It is an error that has also affected the church at various times, in a wider and in local settings, because when you take this approach, it will inevitably lead to legalism. Just sanctification by the law. When you go down that route, you'll find that the fellowship of the church is no longer based upon the gospel. It is based upon rules and regulations. Remember what Paul said when he wrote to the Philippians, that he thanked God for fellowship in the gospel. It wasn't fellowship on the basis of adhering to certain rules and regulations. That when you get to that stage, you've come to a point where you're now seeking to be sanctified by the law. And what happens then, there's a very subtle change. What happens then is that the fellowship of the church becomes governed by conditions instead of conviction. And when you get to that stage, you're into legalism. What do I mean? What do I mean? Well, take for instance our church. We have distinctive beliefs. We have distinctive practices that we adhere to. But they are not
the condition of membership. They're not the condition. We believe in the sanctity of the Lord's Day. We believe that ladies should have their heads covered in the house of God and the public service. We are Presbyterian in our government. We oppose the ecumenical union with Rome. These are distinctives of our beliefs. They are not the condition of membership. And there's a danger for a church to seek to advance its membership on the basis of conditions, that upon the condition that you do this, then you will be brought into membership in this church. No. Our membership is not based on conditions. It's based on convictions. We have the conviction in our heart that this is what we ought to do to please the Lord, and it is that which brings us together in a common union, in a common fellowship. There's a subtle difference there. But you move from the realm of conviction to condition whenever you get to the place where you begin to think that you're sanctified by keeping the law. I did have opportunity in the past to speak to someone, no longer here, so I will mention this. But they were wanting me to take a certain line. And because I wouldn't take that line, their objection was, but we had to do certain things to become Free Presbyterian, to become members of this church. And I said, no. You don't have to do anything to become a member of this church. We do not force anyone to be a member of this church. We do not lay conditions upon anyone entering into membership of this church. The basis of our fellowship and membership is conviction. That we have the conviction in our heart that these things are right. And these are the things that the Lord would have us to stand for. We do not practice speaking in tongues. Well, if somebody practiced speaking in tongues and adhered to that position, why would they want to join membership of this church which does not practice speaking in tongues? You see, it's not a condition of membership. It is a conviction that brings us together. And we can only maintain that so long as we do not go down the road of adopting the theory that we're sanctified by trying to keep the law. It has affected the church in many ways. And it has brought a legalistic spirit that has killed the witness of the gospel in many other places. But then it's also a theory that has had an effect on the church's outlook and mission in society. The church can very easily become law-orientated instead of gospel-orientated. We find this today in what is known as the Reconstructionist movement. It is a movement which believes that it can affect society from the top down by seeking the establishment of righteous laws. And those who would adhere to a Reconstructionist position, they believe that the aim of the church should be to seek the establishment of righteous laws in legislation. But it's a flawed approach. It seeks to make a nation righteous by legislating righteousness. But surely the teaching of the Word of God is this: Righteous laws do not make a righteous nation. It is a righteous nation that makes righteous laws. And how do you get a righteous nation? It's by and through the gospel. Saving the hearts of men, regenerating the souls of men, renewing the mind of men. It only comes by the gospel. And only when the heart of the nation is changed, only then will you have righteous laws in the land. You see, the problem that we are having in society today, if you take, for instance, the homosexual agenda. If you go away back into the history when God visited the nation in revival and multitudes of men and women were saved, the effect of that was felt in Parliament on the statute books. And because there were now righteous men and women, godly men and women, seeking the promotion of righteousness through their members of Parliament, those laws were brought into being. But now we are living in a nation that wants to change those laws. Why? Because the heart of the nation is no longer righteous. It's no longer godly. And you cannot make the nation righteous by simply legislating for righteousness on the statute books. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying we should seek that. Or I'm not saying that we shouldn't defend those laws that are already are in fact. I'm not saying that. But the principle that I'm maintaining here is that if society is going to be changed, it's not going to be changed from the top down. It's going to be changed from the bottom up. And you can only change the people, the heart of the nation, by the gospel. And therefore, the mission and the calling and the task of the church is to go into society and into the nation and preach the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when that gospel goes forth in the power of the Spirit, it will result in the conversion of the hearts of the people. And that will bear fruit in the laws of the land. This principle, this theory that Paul is introducing, highlighting the powerlessness of the law, it has a personal bearing upon us. It has a bearing upon the church in its local and wider context. And it also has a bearing upon the church's mission to society and to the world. Let us not fall into this error. But let us recognize the perception of the law, the purpose of the law to convict the heart of sin, and the powerlessness of the law to save the sinner and to sanctify the believer. Now that will bring us to the difficult part. And I would encourage you to read from verse 7 through to the end. It's difficult to read. It takes time. But let me encourage you to do that. And next week we will come to consider who Paul is talking about when he says, "O wretched man that I am." Who's he talking about? Why does he say this? And I believe when we consider that, the Lord will bless our souls and we will be profited by his word. Let's sing a verse.